Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison. And our program today is a discussion of growth of free thinker groups, what works and doesn't work. And we have a panelist of people who give some ideas on this. We've had a couple of programs which raise some of these issues. We had the UU minister last time who was talking about growth, for example, of the national UU denomination and how she felt that they had broadened their approach to try and bring in more people and became less distinguishable from liberal Christian groups. We had an atheist speaker, vice president of the Atheist Alliance International, who was big on the use of meetup for atheists to connect up with each other in different communities. Today we have a panelist representing Madison Brights. I don't know if we consider you representing the Madison Ethical Discussion Group, but Ron also represents the he's on the board, the national board of the American Ethical Union, and vice president of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. We have Jennifer from the Madison Skeptics, and we have Julie from the First Unitarian Society Doubters Group. So maybe Leslie, you'd like to start.
Bob asked me to talk a little bit about how the National Brights organization helped us here in Madison, the local group, get coordinated. And so what I had noticed, the Brights.net, through some other connections, the Atheist and Agnostics group, all these online groups, and saw Brights. So I looked into it a little bit more and looked like something that was missing maybe in Madison. So I contacted the national organization, the Brights.net, and Ninja, I think is how you pronounce her name, responded and gave advice and information on how to start a group and what might help to keep the group going. They also have on their website, the Brights.net section on how to start and how to get groups going. They also have a way for you to contact other group coordinators, Brights coordinators. And after we got going a little bit, they also offered to extend their nonprofit status to us, so which is a big deal. If we want to get into other projects, we can do fundraising, and it's tax deductible for people who donate whatever. So when we get really going and start doing more projects that require funds, we have an option there, which I think is a good thing. So we just started this year and done a few projects and have a few going, but nothing major yet. So there's about, I think the Facebook group seems to be the biggest group, which has 25 members now. And the Facebook group is good for letting people know we're out there, but it seems to have stalled there. So looking for ideas on how to get people out from behind the computer to do things and to be more active.
What would be some things you think you'd like to do?
Well, the things that we've got going right now, I have a set up with Project Home. You know, they do painting every year for elderly, disabled, and low income. So kind of got connected with them. So on the projects page, you can sign up to do the Project Home on August 15th. Anybody who is available that day can go on the Facebook page and sign up for that. Also the Adopt a Highway project, and we just got a very nice location off of the interstate on Highway 30. So people will see our sign coming off of the interstate into Madison, the Madison Brights sign, just to get some exposure, which was a good thing. We've also got, Bob has forwarded information on, some projects that people are doing in the community, the school supplies project, so we post those up there. So we also have a sort of a book club started. It's not active right now. We had chosen a couple of books. The Brights.net website has a whole list of books that are by Brights or about people with naturalistic worldviews. And so we were kind of maybe work through that list, and it's more of a social event. So.
Well, then my question, number one, where does that name come from?
The Brights?
Yeah.
I think Daniel Dennett, I think, is the one who coined the term, the Brights. And I think he was just a way, and I think there was a big hoo-ha in the atheist community that, you know, why shouldn't we call ourselves atheists? And I think the analogy they make is with like gay and homosexual. You know, homosexual to people seems more threatening. I don't know why, but gay, you know, it wasn't until the term gay came about that things started to move along. That's what people are saying. So they're thinking that if you go with something like Brights as opposed to atheist, it might at least get you in the door to talk to people, and they won't get, you know, all drama about the atheist label.
But if somebody asks you, what does that mean,
Brights,
what do you tell them?
That it's just people with a naturalistic worldview as opposed to a supernatural worldview. So, just, and it's
more...
Do
you use the term atheist as a subcategory of the term Brights?
You can, sure. Atheist, humanist, I mean, it's all, you know, what people choose to use.
Well, I always liked it a couple of years ago. Walmart, in their big Christmas campaign, used Be Bright.
Excellent.
Hey, you think they know?
So has anybody come to you and asked if you're associated with Walmart?
I think that was the thinking, as you said. It's more the naturalistic worldview is also, you know, it deals with the psychics and the astrology and things like that that may not be religious but are, you know, in the pseudosciences.
The woo-woo,
yes,
we call
the mystics.
I hate to be harping on that, but for someone who is not in the in-group of these things, like
right,
skeptics and so forth, Bright associates a value. Somebody who is brighter than other people. Isn't
right,
that what
that's
you
want? Yeah.
And that's been a complaint of it all along. But
right,
if you think
it's like
super people
well,
who have
worse.
But the opposite of that is supers. So we're not putting down people who have a supernatural worldview. They're called supers in this vocabulary. But I mean it's just a term.
The opposite of bright is
dim. Yeah.
Most people
well,
are burned out.
So it's dim,
that's
dim
what happens
light,
after a few years, doesn't it?
Or dim light. The metaphor is light.
Let's move on to our second panelist.
And as they said on Monty Python, now for something completely different. Unless you want to let Julie talk next, because in some respects, Jennifer, I'm sorry. The skeptics are starting relatively newly here in Madison too, right? And,
mm-hmm.
It might be interesting just to do a little comparing and contrasting between the Brights and the skeptics before I'll
okay
talk. So, but I don't mind talking next. But.
Okay, well, I wasn't supposed to be the official panelist, but our the official panelist isn't here. So I started Madison Skeptics through meetup.com because on Meetup, different people can say what they're interested in, and then they're notified if a group starts with that. So there are already a list of people that were interested. So once I started the group, it was sort of a pre-made, you know, group already there. At the same time, John Rummel started a group on Facebook, and neither of us knew about the other one. My group had a meeting or two, and then we found out about John's group, and we decided, well, we should have two groups in Madison called Madison Skeptics, so we merged them, and it's been very successful so far.
How many members do you have now?
Well, it's interesting on the, like you said, it's hard to move it from the internet to real life. I know on the Facebook group, there's like 80-some people signed up. We usually get about 20 to our meetings, which are twice a month.
I think you got over 100. Yeah, I think you have 103
now. Oh, okay.
Yeah. All of a sudden.
I know. Right. Yeah. And Meetup has a lot of people, too. I've been surprised. At least once a week, we have a sign up in Meetup. It's been really surprising, and I think it kind of means that Madison is really wanting something like this. For skeptics who maybe are interested in organizing around an issue of God or no God so much, or want something in beyond that, who want to address things like alternative health, pseudoscience, things like that. And I know the Humanist Union does address those things, but people don't really know that, I guess.
Could you speak?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. So we've been very successful in having meetings like every other week. We get speakers often from the university to talk to us. We also have had members themselves from a wide variety of fields talk to us. Recently, one that was surprising was the issue of child welfare systems. We had a woman talk to us about evidence-based child welfare systems and how there was so much resistance to that because the welfare specialists thought that they could tell on their own to be able to handle these cases. So we have had a lot of really interesting talks about that. So.
Mm-hmm. Been successful in meeting every other week, which is a pretty ambitious schedule for a new group. Yeah.
Right. And there's been some talk about whether we can sustain that or not, but
I'm curious as to the demographics of your group, since this group tends to be, like, maybe you're the youngest member here. I'm thinking with Meetup that it might be a younger group of people.
Yes, I think so. There are some older people that come there, definitely, but it's a more even mix, I think.
Definitely a younger mix than the Humanist Union.
Yeah.
And the Madison Brights is, too.
We get several college students, grad students there. That's been really nice.
Can we say a little bit about...
Excuse me?
What is your membership?
Well, we get about 20 people a week our meetings... but online, I guess it's past 1,000 on the Facebook group. So a lot of people are signed. Not 1,000, I'm sorry. 100. 100.
Oh, so, zeros, they're hard to handle.
Yeah. So.
You can hope.
There are a lot of people, I guess, that like the idea but don't necessarily want to come to meetings.
Right. What would be an example? Can you give me a couple of examples of some of the talks that you've had?
Sure. We've had. A talk on evolution by a guy at the university, a cultural anthropologist, about human evolution. We had a talk early on about runes. Runes by, like, Scandinavian runes by a Scandinavian studies major, graduate student.
Is that a positive or a negative talk?
Well, I mean, runes... It was about
that
the difference.
R-U-N-E-1?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. It was about the difference between kind of the New Age view of runes and what they actually mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the actual runic carvings, most of them say, like, you know, so-and-so was here. And they don't have this
magic... George Washington slept here.
They don't have these magical meanings.
Magical meanings. They've acquired translation.
Right. That has no basis in... Yeah, it's what they actually mean. So, we've had talks about... Oh, what are some of the other ones? I'm going blank.
It's just on a wide variety.
Right, science, a lot of science-based stuff.
Did people go to that talk on the mazes and stuff that was at the Middleton Library?
Oh, no, we never did. I think people forgot.
But,
Do you want to say a little bit about how John collected people on Facebook?
Well, what he did was he searched for anyone in the area that had atheist as their religion, or had the word skeptic in their profile, had people like Daniel Dennett or Richard Dawkins as their favorite books. He just went through a whole bunch of keywords of people that might be interested. And he just sent out invitations everywhere. And he actually got a very positive response to that. A lot of people signed up to it.
Right. Yeah. Like in a matter of a week or two, we had 80 people.
Yeah. Yeah. People
were amazing.
People responded very well.
Well, I guess that, you know, in some respects, that shows how out of touch those of us of my generation are with these kinds of things, because I know that in our groups, in the ethical societies, and probably in some of the UU congregations perhaps as well, and other groups that have a somewhat older demographic, it seems that people are a little more concerned usually about their privacy and their right to privacy and their right to not be inundated with more things than they really want to deal with. And yet, for it's clear, a lot of people now, you know, they put their listings on Facebook and things like that, and I think it's not really surprising that people would respond to that, because why do they put those things there? I think they are reaching out. And that's where I think I would bring in the point of departure about ethical culture and the Unitarian Universalists, and I would include the Society for Humanistic Judaism as another humanist-oriented, congregationally-based group, at least here in the United States. And that is the thing, is the question of being congregationally based. We all evolved out of a different concept, you might say, about how people want to organize in groups and be in communities together with like-minded people. And of course, that all happened way before the internet. Ethical culture is pretty young. It's been around for like 130 years. Humanistic Judaism as a term or as an organized thing has only been around like since maybe the 50s or 60s, so you know, maybe 50 or 60 years. Unitarianism, I guess, started more or less in the early 19th century, but kind of evolved out of liberal Christian denominations.
Actually, its roots are 500 years old.
Right, the roots go back farther, sure.
That's one.
Yeah.
Yeah. One group in Europe decided not to believe in
the Trinity.
In the Trinity, yeah. Exactly.
And I think that, you know, this is where the, in a lot of ways, the connection point is at this point in time, is that those of us that have been in these congregationally based organizations, many of us are looking at older and older demographics. And younger people are clearly resonating, at least at the first level of contact, through things like the internet, through Facebook, and those meetup and those kinds of things. And so they are very successful. And I know we're all doing the same things, or we're trying to. The Unitarians started this Church of the Larger Fellowship, I think, to reach out to people in communities where there's no Unitarian congregation. And the Ethical Societies did the same thing. We have this thing called the Ethical Society Without Walls, which is similarly designed to reach out to people who are in communities where there's no ethical society. And so their initial point of contact is through the internet, and their membership comes in through an internet-based organization. So trying to figure out how to bring that into what is normally congregationally based, which in our minds means, you know, we come together on whatever Sunday mornings or whenever, like the Prairie UUs do, you know, and have our gatherings and our meetings and so on. It's a whole kind of different dynamic with the groups that are doing this a different way. And yet people, I think, are still hungry for the same kind of things. I think most people are social creatures, and they do want to interact with other people, and they want to find other people based on commonalities of beliefs and understandings. And so they're looking for these various groups, and however they find them, whether it comes through skeptics, atheists, humanists, brights, you know, we've got all these different names, and I guess, you know, one way or another, somebody finds one of them. I happen to sit on the boards of two organizations that are coalitions, one here in the United States and one internationally, that include a whole bunch of these groups. Like I've met Minja, for example, at several meetings, Dynamite Lady. Yet, at some level, I think it speaks to the fact that collectively we're not really all that successful, because why is there even a need for a new group like the Brights? You know, why weren't the fact that there already are skeptics all over the world, there are skeptics organizations all over the world, there are atheist organizations, there are humanist organizations, there are free thinking organizations, there's the Freedom From Religion Foundation right here in Madison that has over 10,000 members. You know, they were like blown away when they passed the 10,000 mark about a year ago. They never envisioned that would happen. But in terms of, you know, what we try and what works for us, I think it's very different depending on whether we're working through these kind of basically internet-driven organizations, or whether we're working through a more of a physical congregational setting, you know, where groups try to meet together in person and have a building and things like that. So we can talk more about that a little later, but I know we got one more panelist first.
That's Julie.
I'm from the First Unitarian Society Doubters Group. The Doubters is the elder of these groups here. We're sort of, I'm not sure of the exact date, but probably about 5 or 6 years ago, it started out as an adult education class at First Unitarian called The Spiritual Aspects of Orthodox Atheism, taught by Bert Bitter. And when I signed up, they told me the class was full, and they would only take like 10 people, and I said, well, is there some kind of constraints, like size of it? And they said no. And so I said, well, can you see if they could let more people in? And by the time we got done, we had over 20 people that wanted to sign up for it. And it started out with kind of a discussion led by Bert, but then it became more of like each person, how they had arrived at, you know, their belief system or atheism, agnosticism, whatever they doubting. After the class was done, I think it ran about 6 or 8 weeks, nobody really had this kind of connection with other people. It was kind of like, oh, this is really a unique situation here. And so we decided to continue meeting, and we met, until recently, we met pretty much once a month for like the last 4 or 5 years. And they did a big, when they were doing the big construction project at First Unitarian, we met at the Atlanta Bread, and it was just pretty much whoever show up. We always met on the third Monday of the month. And we had, in our heyday, we have a listserv, which is a little, it's run through First Unitarian Society. And it's a little different than having like a Yahoo group, because nobody, it's kind of closed. People don't really find you. People didn't want to move it to a Yahoo group. It was kind of interesting in that we had a lot of political discussions, and there were a lot of very contentious things that people didn't want the politics side of it, but yet there's so much of the religious aspects being thrown in, especially with the Bush administration years, with religion being thrown at us all the time, that people were really kind of upset about all that. And I remember one time I referred to myself as an atheist on the listserv, and I got berated for calling myself an atheist. And I said, I thought at least I could be comfortable in this group using that term. But we had a human light celebration that was very nice. It was a potluck I think we had 50 people come for that.
Humanist
Union. We had both Annie and Laurie came and spoke to the group, and Dan came a couple of times. I think the most memorable one, well, first he was coming back from their convention, and he got sick on the plane on the way back. He got food poisoning, so he ended up totally forgetting that he was supposed to show up. Well, he came the next month, and we met in the sanctuary over at main meeting hall, and they have a really nice piano there. Well, he played music for us for an hour, and that was just wonderful because he's an amazing musician. Yeah. And he loved that piano too, but we've connected with them quite a bit on just having them come and talk to the group. We've had a number of people from the university come and talk. I think the most memorable one I remember was we had somebody coming to speak, and we usually open these up to the whole congregation if they wanted to come and listen to it. And I had a kind of a working relationship with Lee Rayburn when he used to do his morning show on Air America and on the mic 921. And I sent him an email and I said, we're going to have this guy come and lecture. And he said, is it okay if I interview him? And I said, go for it. So he called him up and interviewed him in the morning and then announced that we were going to have him speak that night at the First Unitarians. That was free publicity. We had kids came from schools and did like reports on, and it was about evolution too. He was talking about evolution. So we had some really nice speakers and discussions, and it's kind of, I think it's like one of those things, it's gone nova now, it's kind of burning its way out, but I think that's probably because there are other sources, and it's kind of like when you start something, it's kind of like when gays first came out of the closet and stuff, and now it seems just kind of normal that you see, you don't even blink an eye, and that's kind of, I'm hoping we get to that point where you can say you're an atheist and nobody cares. So.
Why would anyone care?
But they do, they'd rather their children marry Muslims than atheists. That was a study that was done.
Why do you care that I wear this pin?
I'd rather, yep.
Why do you care that I wear this pin?
Because I don't think you should announce you're an atheist. I think to me, it's like saying, oh, there's no doubt there's a God. And there's something wrong with you if you don't believe it. It's sort of the same thing, but from the other side. Like, I mean, how could you know?
That isn't the only definition of atheist.
Well.
Isn't the one I subscribe to.
Why would you care?
I mean, maybe Julie would be a good person to address the one person keeps it going situation.
Yes. it's kind of like I moderate a number of Yahoo groups, and when you get down to the point where you have to like post a weekly question, or you really have to kind of keep, you feel like you're just doing all the heavy lifting yourself. You feel like the group has kind of like lost its, kind of purpose, and it's time to either move on or redesign yourself. Last solstice, Bert invited all the doubters and all the other people he knows to his house for a solstice party. That was wonderful. And I personally find solstice to be so much more meaningful to me than Christmas. Especially, we saw like films like The God Who Wasn't There, and we do discussions of those things, and a lot of those things are very mind, they open you up to the historical reference of Jesus and whether or not he existed. And so a lot of the, as far as new people starting groups, I don't know if atheists are just not joiners or by nature, it's something they don't feel like they really need. As much as religious people need that connection. I mean, I always enjoyed the meetings, and probably was one of the reasons I kept it going this long. I just thought the people, they were intellectually stimulating. It was so much better than any other discussions we could have.
And most of your meetings were sort of winging it, weren't they, rather than having a speaker?
Well, usually we just had people would just come and talk, and maybe just, they'd discuss we might, well, that's why a lot of our stuff, I think, became political, like what's going on today in the news or whatever. And it's, it was, but I think we did things too, like we collected socks for the men's homeless shelter and tried to do, you know, some kind of caring kind of things too that, through the years as far as.
When you became unavailable to meet on Mondays, has the group ever met since then?
We did meet for quite a while on, you know, like I said, at the Atlanta Bread.
Right.
We'd go there and meet, but then since my situation has changed, I haven't been able to be there. And I know that they were reserving a room, but whether or not the group is continuing to meet, we still have a listserv.
Right.
I still get the notices.
My impression is it exists only online.
Yeah, pretty much.
I wonder, Ron, if you could say a little bit about the Madison Ethical Discussion Group, which your son founded.
Well, let me give a little broader background to, or put it in some context first. I think that people that have studied religious organizations, and I'm using that term very broadly and loosely, so that it can even include those of us who are non-believers, there are specific points in time when people generally seek out a community of that type. And, you know, those are the kind of the major milestones that we think about, you know, birth, marriage, death, and raising children. And so one of the things that religions traditionally have provided for people is a place for them to recognize births, to celebrate marriages, to provide some kind of education, and I'll use that word loosely too, because sometimes I know we think of it as indoctrination of your children, and comfort and solace as we face death. Those are the points at which, you know, most people seek groups and find them if they're congregationally based. And so groups that are trying to grow are usually looking at, you know, how can they make more people aware of them at those particular points in their life journeys. Now our sons, we've been members of Ethical Culture since I was a college freshman, and we've been members since we've been married, and we raised our sons in the Ethical Society Sunday School, and they both moved to cities where there is no Ethical Society. Even if they had wanted to maintain an affiliation, first as young marrieds without children and then with children, they didn't have a society to do it. My one son is here in Madison, and we had talked a few times about the fact that he really would love for there to be an ethical society here, and part of it was he was thinking ahead to when he had children, which he does now, and you know when they would eventually be looking for a Sunday school experience, some moral education, more than just what parents provide in the home. And he encountered another woman who had actually contacted the National AEU office about starting an ethical society. And we had corresponded with her, not me personally, but other people. So we put her in touch with my son, and they worked together for a while and tried to launch a group, but it turned out what she really wanted was an atheist group, and she really did not want a congregationally based group like an ethical society. So they parted, but I think Brian had contacted a few people that he knew who were interested, and over maybe a period of a year or two after that, they decided to start a discussion group. And so they call it the Madison Ethical Discussion Group, and it's been going on for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years now, I think. They got some materials from the National Ethical Office to use as foundational materials for discussions, you know, to talk about what is ethical culture and, you know, what do we believe and, you know, how do we, you know, think through our thoughts about our worldview and so on. And then they've expanded into more of the kinds of meetings that I would say probably both of you would have. Sometimes movies, some discussions, occasionally a outside speaker. And they still meet monthly, have a potluck discussion and a dinner, a potluck dinner or breakfast, depending on the time of year. They're going on. They've expanded a little bit. They started out as a group, a specific designated group of people because they were going through this course of study, but then afterwards they kind of opened it up, and I don't know, they may have as many as 20 or 24 people total, but at any given month they probably only have 10 or 12 come. And that would get me back to what I was thinking about in the context of congregational growth, and the people that have studied congregations have sort of loosely categorized 4 different stages of congregational development or life. And it isn't necessarily development. Development isn't the right word, because some groups stay in one particular phase forever. You know, they don't, so it's developed, and that doesn't mean that they're undeveloped. So development's not a good word. But the smallest one is called a family congregation or a family-sized congregation. And typically, that's exactly, I think, the kind of thing that you're encountering, is that there's like one or two key people that hold that group together. Mm-hmm. And usually they're not paid. Usually they're volunteers. They're passionate. They really care. They really believe in the idea of the group. They may have been the people that started it, or maybe not. It depends on how long it's been around. In your case, you started it. You know, when we moved to Baltimore, we started out, we were in the St. Louis Ethical Society. The Ethical Society in St. Louis is the largest ethical society in the United States. It's not as big as First Unitarian Society, but it's a very decent-sized group of, you know, at least like around 500 members or something. A full Sunday school, you know, a broad range of programs, just like the First Unitarian Society has here. Then we moved to Baltimore. Baltimore had one of these little family-sized groups. You know, they had just hired a part-time leader for the first time in years. Before that, they had been basically run by a few key people that were really involved in it. So they were trying to move to this other stage, which is the pastoral stage, where they actually have, to loosely use the term pastor, a minister in ethical culture, we call them leaders. In Judaism, they call them rabbis, whatever. And so that's like a different kind of size group, generally, with a different set of issues and problems to deal with. And then there's the groups that are usually somewhat bigger than that, and they're called program size, because they have much more programming. And that gets back again to, you know, what do people look for when they go to these congregations, besides just having a place, say, to educate their kids in Sunday school and maybe meet some other people that they happen to share a similar worldview with? You know, what else are they looking for? And they're looking for all kinds of things, but some of those things they're looking for is like doing some kind of community action projects, you know. And program groups will have more of those kinds of things. And then there's what they call the corporate model, which First Unitarian would fit, because, you know, they're really large. They have like, you know, multiple staff people. Usually have a pretty substantial building facility that occupies a lot of their time and effort and focus. So all those things are parts of how even within any given organization like, say, the UUs, you've got all those different sized congregations throughout the UUs in the United States. You've got those little family-sized groups and pastoral-sized groups and program groups and corporate groups. And each one of them, they have, you know, they have a lot of different things that take up some of their attention. And so the people that are in those groups, besides the fundamental things that they came to the group for, are dealing with, you know, to the extent that they want to be involved, what some of those other issues are. And then within them, you know, some of the programs that develop are a kind of special interest program. So like you started the, what became the doubters group there. They might have a group for gays and lesbians. They might have a group for parents without partners, or, you know, or children without parents, or, you know, any kinds of things, you know, families of alcoholics or other drug abusers. But, so they can develop all these different kinds of small groups. And when the organizations nationally, like the American Ethical Union or the UUA, is thinking about growth in an overall sense, they're trying to think of it in the context of, you know, how can they get new congregations where there aren't any, what size will they be, and also with all the existing groups that maybe feel like they're struggling a little bit and might want to grow, what does that mean for that group? And it means different things depending on the size of the group.
I think the Madison Ethical Discussion Group is a good example of word of mouth as the only means of communicating and getting new people. They don't seem to be particularly interested in growing, at least not very fast, but they invite friends from time to time and they get new people that way. I offered them a website at one point and they said, no, we're not ready for that. So they're really not interested in spreading the word and, beyond their own group of friends.
Where do you meet?
They meet in different members' homes. Rotating around.
And they communicate coming programs by email. And emails.
Right. And that would be difficult for them to handle, like all of a sudden a big group in some home that 15 people fit. And I just see this swarm of people. Like, well, what are we going to do with them?
Right. Well, in one sense, they're facing, I won't necessarily call it a crisis yet, but they're on the crux of the same issue that I think Julie has encountered, which is that our son Brian was, you know, the original driving force of it. He's got a full-time job. He's a city council person, which could be another full-time job easily if he had the time to devote to being a full-time job, but it certainly occupies most of his evenings every week. He's got meetings of one sort or another. He's got two young children. He's trying to be a husband, a father, a city council person. And so he devotes perhaps less and less time to even sending out emails about the group. And the group is struggling to like fill in that void, you know, how's it going to happen without him, sort of, or not necessarily without him, but, you know, is somebody else willing to take a little more of the leadership? And it's been interesting for us coming in, and, you know, we've joined the group and we've gone to most of the meetings since we've been here, obviously, that if he doesn't send something out before a few weeks before a meeting, it's almost like happenstance that maybe just a week before somebody will say, are we having a meeting next week? Where's it going to be? What time? Who's hosting it? What's the topic?
Yeah. I've heard that.
But at least they divide up the responsibility for meetings. So there's a lot of different people involved in putting on a topic and hosting the meeting.
Right.
The interesting part in my case is I'm not even a member of First Unitarian Society, and I never was.
But
I got the job of listserv administrator, and I said, well, I'm not a member. And they said, that's okay. We'll work this out. So they put one of the pastors on as a kind of a coal person.
Oh.
And you know, I always would add new people, you know, email addresses and stuff as I would get them. But yeah, I think you do. It's difficult to find somebody that, because you do get burnt out after a while too, when you kind of feel like you're just struggling to keep things moving. You feel like you're stuck, and you know, where is everybody? And you know, you're kind of doing it by yourself. But I still think that the whole genre of the non-believer is a different category than the churchgoer. People can go to church and sit there and think of all the work they have to do at home and stuff, but they showed up, they did what they're supposed to do, and they go back home. And I don't know if a lot of them are connected when they sit there. And I think the people that are the non-believers and stuff, I think they have a pretty good idea of where their belief system lies, and they maybe don't need that validation that, you know, of going to a group. So we're kind of up against a wall with the mentality of the people we're dealing with.
Actually, I don't know if I particularly agree with your statement. I'm a member of the Unitarian Society, but I would rather be a member of an organized atheist group. Although I love my Unitarian church. But per Ron's summary of the different things that you look for in life, I think that sense of community is completely missing from just groups that meet here or there or other where. I think it's an intellectually stimulating, and I wouldn't mind going and attending the Brights or the Skeptics, or, you know, it would be very interesting to me.
But
the whole community and the dedication to one another as a group of people, the caring, the structure that a more traditional, I would say, religious organization brings to the table is completely missing. And I think that is really, in my mind, why the atheist group, whether you call them Brights or Skeptics, or I guess I'll just call them atheists for lack of a better word, why they're not growing. Because when I raised my children, I didn't want them going to a traditional Sunday school because I felt like it was more indoctrination. Although I went to a mainstream at the time, United Methodist Church, I would prefer that they get the kind of education that it sounds like the ethical groups provide. But those things are so hard to find. They're so far and few between. So I feel like if the atheist groups could, and I think the Brights are onto something, although I do not like the term Brights. I know it's very controversial. A lot of people don't. But I think they're onto something.
Not my favorite either.
Atheist is not a good word.
No.
It means, it has a negative connotation, meaning not theist. So, I think there has to be a way to describe.
I think the humanist,
our belief system.
I
maybe
think the
humanist
could
more,
be a very good
yeah.
bridge
yeah.
to all of that.
Right.
To,
and if
know,
we had strong
union.
Communities
right.
of humanist thinking
right.
and organizational
that
structure,
may come,
I think that would be.
I mean, I think that these groups are building the bridge, and with all the new atheist books out there, and when you see that the largest growing group are non-believers. You know, this is just starting. It's kind of on an upswing here.
Right. I hope so. But I do believe people are people. And whether you're an atheist or a very, you know, God-believing person, that you have the same needs to connect with people, to educate your children, to have some kind of moral system. And I wish there were more choices for people who have a naturalistic view of the world. And I commend everyone for all your efforts
That's what I always say. I said, well, religion can offer you the light at the end of the tunnel. And I said, what can we offer? Darkness? Blackness? I guess I'd opt for the light too.
Do the various organizations here have mission statements?
We don't.
That sort of.
Yeah, we've kind of adopted the Brights. .net, the national organization as a whole on a
mission.
Right, we don't have it on
at the national level.
Right.
The ethical humanists.
We sort of have been an unofficial. We've discussed whether to be an atheist group explicitly or not, but we've decided not to be. We just address claims that can be addressed by science. So we sort of have that unofficial mission statement to address those claims, not whether there is or is not a God, but whether the statue actually is weeping or prayer actually heals you or not.
You're on a quest for truth.
What I've noted with Unitarian fellowships is where you hit a wall is with RE, that we have a group now here, we're either young and don't have any children or we're old, our children are gone, and you can't get that those young families that have children. And if you do, your houses are not big enough to use them anyway. And so you've got a real problem. You either got to get a place with RE rooms and have people who are willing to be RE teachers, or you're going to just reach a plateau to where you can't attract people, and if you attract them, you can't hold them.
Right. The children pieces.
That's what really is hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
Now, Jennifer, in Skeptics group, are there a lot of families with children, or is it?
Yes, there are. Okay. And we did have a picnic with the Humanist Union and the Brights, where a lot of people brought their children. One of our members led them on nature walks. And that was really nice, just to get to know each other and hang out without really a mission at that time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way to get to grow, is to have more of the programming aspects, have the clubs for the kids, have the Rational Sunday School. It's actually in the Humanist magazine this time on the whole curriculum for the Rational Sunday School, which I thought was just great. They have a whole and resources and things to get. So what we need to get is parents interested in, you know, that's where it's going to start. That's why I'm thinking the Humanist and Humanist is like a, you know, told Bob, I think people can relate to that a lot more. So if we put out a notice saying, you know, calling it Rational Sunday School, calling it something fun, but through the Humanists, you know, even if all the other groups are participating, but to put it under the Humanist Union, I think we would get more people involved, more families involved, because it's not, you know, who doesn't like a Humanist, for crying out loud?
How long a list do you want?
I could
keep you here for the rest of the week.
I just have one question, and that seems to be the whole issue of morality and possibly ethics. And you made a comment that the Sunday school teaches morality, things that the kids don't learn at home. And I'm thinking, well, what is that, and what are you using to like identify that morality? Is this teachings of
I think this this article, and I can you know, send the reference to it. It's more on respect, responsibility, those kind of ethical issues. But you don't teach. You don't have a class called fairness. You have fun activities where they don't even know that that's what they're learning about. Kids. This is geared toward kids. I'm not sure what age that would start. But the whole idea is, and I think all that programming that churches do, where they take kids out, you know, camping for a week, and it's mostly fun, but then, of course, the last couple days are all, you know, fun ends. But in the meantime, they're being indoctrinated. But I think, you know, whose ethics is your question? Are you teaching? I mean, I think they get these things at home. I think it's just more reinforcing
in a social setting.
Yeah, right, in a social setting with other kids who, you know.
You could build a very nice, informal Sunday school for budding humanists using children's literature. I've worked once with a group of the Jane Addams Awards, deciding what books should be getting these awards. And you find an awful lot of very good stuff. It takes a lot of work. You'd have to have a committee that really can get into children's literature. And it's wonderful. It's a fascinating thing. But if you'd use that, you'd also have materials that would be interesting to kids. They'd have good illustrations and so forth. But you'd need a bunch of people who are into that.
Right.
I see this article. The article quotes Dale McGowan, who was the editor of a book called Parenting Beyond Belief a couple of years ago, and more recently, Raising Free Thinkers, on how to implement the recommendations in Parenting Beyond Belief. And he's been invited to speak at ethical groups and Unitarian churches all around the country. And he's had more than 100 cities invite him. And so he started an online, on YouTube, series of seminars that you can go to and watch. And I'm hoping that there will be a group forming in Madison of parents who are interested in non-religious education for their kids on moral issues and this sort of thing.
You think someone has started that?
No, I'm hoping that. I've suggested it to the RE program at Prairie, and the current director said it sounds interesting. Okay. And maybe we can get something.
You do have a problem like here. You say kids, well, they range from kids in a carrier all the way up to teenagers, and you can't put them all in one thing. And you get teachers, well, maybe 1 week you have 3 10-year-olds, the next week there aren't any.
Right.
And see, it's very difficult. It sounds easy, but it's not. It's the most difficult thing, I think. And now you find, and I'm sure you find, it used to be, say, 20 years ago when women didn't work too much. A lot of women volunteer to do all this stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now you don't. Now it's very hard, because it's hard work. And it's a lot of responsibility, and it takes some talent as well as, you know, I can read out of that thing, and I'm just hopeless. I'd rather be on the highway cleanup than on the RE. I find a lot less stuff I don't understand.
Yeah. I do think this is hitting a fundamental issue, though, because I do feel like there are a lot of people. I mean, somebody said that, you know, I think there's surveys that are done that people would rather live next to almost anyone rather than an atheist. And I think that's because there's not a lot of education out there, and atheist means amoral to a lot of people.
Right.
So when you publish humanist curriculum, so people understand, like, well, if you go to Sunday school and you don't talk about the Bible, what do you talk about? I think there'd be a lot more, people would realize that we all have a lot more in common, regardless of whether we have the Bible as our belief system or some other belief system.
No.
So,
wrong.
I just feel like there's a lot of lack of education and understanding about humanist thinking. And if we could have more humanist type Sunday schools, then people would start to understand a little bit more that there is a moral structure. Truth and wisdom aren't just all from the Bible.
Right.
I think that brings up an interesting point, though. What you were saying, is there a body of information? And I think, you know, like a lot of the right-wing people always talk about situational ethics against some kind of an evil.
Yeah.
And actually, though, if you have a group of children and you present a moral problem to them, bouncing those things off of each other helps them to come up with a moral solution or a moral attitude. You know, like, you know, your friend is, you see your friend take something from a drugstore. What do you think about that? And then, you know, these open-ended kind of ideas. But they're very unpalatable to people who like pat answers. So it's a kind of an interesting juxtaposition, this question that you bring up here about, you know, why wouldn't people who are Christians see a similarity with people who want to be morally good but don't necessarily believe in any of the Christian dogma?
But they can't, because the minute you say you're a moral person if you don't believe in the Bible, well, then their argument is lost. They can never say that. Christians can never say that a non-believer can be on the same level as they are, because otherwise their purpose in believing in the Bible is no longer valid. If I can be as good a person and as good a moral person as an atheist, as a Christian,
why be a Christian?
Why believe in a supernatural power? I mean, my theories have always been that as an atheist, my ethics are much higher than a Christian, because I can't get forgiveness for something I'm wrong with. It's on my shoulders. I can't go and get, you know, say a prayer or get absolution or whatever. Right. And that seems to be the easy way out, is that you sin on Saturday night, you go to church on Sunday and you're forgiven, and then you go back out and do it all over again.
I feel like I'm morally responsible to the next person. I'm not morally responsible to God.
Right.
So it's kind of like a more earthy sort of a...
Well, I mean, people always think that we think we're better, and I do.
You don't have to tell them that.
See, you think you're bright. You're upright.
It's a sin to think you're...
If you get away from the term atheist, Christian, initiative and really go into the even classical literature. You start with Aesop's fables. They can be fun for kids, and they are morals in every darn one of them. And sure. I mean, even the conservatives don't argue as much with classical literature as they do with, you know, the term atheist. It can be done. And I mean, okay, I taught, I used to teach German literature, and but, you know, you get into the early literature and you can do so much with it, because the very early classical literature was not averse to teaching. That was part of the Roman rules of rhetoric and so forth. And you could do that. And as I'm talking about it, it sounds fascinating. Yeah, like a real challenge.
Nothing like a person who's excited about their topic. really matters.
Word atheist. That guy that came and talked to us, he said, "I start out. I tell people I'm an atheist because that's the worst thing they can think of to call me." And if I call it to myself, it takes a wit out of their sense.
That's good. Right? Yeah. I wonder if these concepts could be incorporated into sort of alternative schools. Our granddaughter, for example, is in one of those, what is it, the Waldorf school in Anchorage, Alaska. And then there are other similar ones, I guess.
There's a Waldorf school right near us, isn't there?
We
could get to the people who determine the curriculum in older schools and other similar schools for
the schools
preschoolers
teach,
and young.
The schools
young
teach
kids.
Ethics.
Let me just say a word or two about education, because certainly from the Ethical Society perspective, it's been something that's been thought about from the very beginning. The man who essentially started ethical culture in 1876, although he had a lot of other people that, you know, more or less prevailed upon him to do it, so it wasn't an individual effort. But education was very important. And what he realized in New York City, at least at that time, was there was this huge distinction in the way people were educated, and it depended on if their parents were religious or put them in a religious school, they had one kind of education. And so there were like Catholic schools and so on and so forth. And if their parents were maybe non-believers, but they were relatively affluent, they could send them to some of the really upscale private schools that charged a lot of money, and they could get a really good education. But for most of the working class people, they had to go to the public schools, which were, especially in some of the working class neighborhoods, were pretty inferior, and the kids were getting very inferior educations. And so his idea was to start private schools that would be every bit as good as the private schools that were expensive, but that would be really affordable for working class people. And they actually called the first one the Working Man's School. They started in New York City. And eventually it evolved into what's now called the Ethical Culture Schools. And sadly to say, from some of our perspectives, it's evolved into the same kind of upscale private schools that are very expensive, very exclusive, hard to get into. So it's completely lost touch with Felix Adler's vision of what those schools were supposed to be in the first place. Now these, of course, are separate schools from the Sunday schools that you have in the Ethical Society. Like you would have in a Unitarian congregation or in any other church for that matter, where the kids go on Sundays to get, you know, the so-called moral education. But instrumental within the curriculum of the ethical culture schools is, you know, a very strong ethical component. Although we've talked to a few people who are graduates of the ethical culture schools of, you know, more recent times, and some of them have said that it was kind of easy to miss a lot of that ethical component to the education if you so chose. But perhaps that's true of even kids that go to like Catholic high schools.
Yeah.
They can probably miss the Catholicism if they put their
I'm
mind
sure
to missing
Cheney
it.
Obviously missed out. So what about becoming part of the Catholic school movement?
Well, there's that too, and I'll tell you, for example, and I was going to say a little something about the American Humanists. I forgot. You know, they started as a nationwide organization, first of members, and then started developing chapters in different localities because people wanted to have more interaction. And then some of those chapters wanted to get more, I don't think they would ever use the term congregation, but some of them wanted to get a little more like congregations. And they had children and they wanted to talk about education. So one of the reasons they've developed this educational stuff, they actually took a guy who was working with us at Ethical Culture on developing some curricula that we're putting together primarily for the people who are members of the Ethical Society Without Walls, but really for anybody to be able to have materials to do Sunday school education in the home for people that are in places where there is no ethical society or no Unitarian congregation. So the guy, Bob Behrman, who's developing most of this curriculum material for the humanists, has done that for us too. But the other thing is there's a humanist group in Florida on the sort of Tampa, St. Pete area of Florida, or the kind of West Coast. They started a charter school called the Carl Sagan Academy. And I've talked to the guy who was instrumental in that, and it's really an admirable thing. And it's, but he said if they knew it was going to be unbelievably difficult, and it turned out to be even 10 times more difficult than they thought. And he said, you know, if they had known how hard it was going to be, they probably would have never done it. But I mean, they're glad they did it, I think. But it's just like amazingly difficult. So, I mean, it can be done, but it's not easy. It's not just something you say, oh, let's do it, and you just go out and do it.
On the Church of the Larger Fellowship, that's been around for many, many years, and we got it when there wasn't even any internet. And one of the rules was you couldn't belong to that if you were within a certain number of miles from Unitarian Fellowship, because they didn't want to take people away from that. And they would also send you names of any Unitarians who might be within a certain radius. So
right. We
lived remote, and we got every month, I think, we got a packet that had daily readings and all that stuff. And so it was pretty nice, I thought.
Yeah.
But that was the rule. If you were near a Unitarian,
you couldn't. Right. And of course, that's...
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, that, you know, in a sense, that's organizationally driven, and it's driven, and I think the UUs in some respects are like Ethical Culture in the sense that, you know, we are not organizations that are really hierarchical with a group of people up there at the top somewhere, whether it's on Beacon Street in Boston or wherever the UU headquarters is, or whether it's on Central Park West in New York where Ethical Culture is, who sit around and make all these decisions and tell everybody and all the congregations, this is what you're going to do. You know, we're totally different.
There's no white smoke coming out of the chimney.
Right. And so, you know, the congregations are really the backbone of both of our organizations, and they really are the policy-making groups. The UUs have their general assembly every year, where the congregations come together. We have our annual assemblies in Ethical Culture. When they started something like that, they wanted to be really careful not to like irritate all the people who were in the existing congregations, which are the backbone bone of their group. And so, you know, they clearly, the congregations will say, well, you're going to take our members away. We can't afford that. So they say, well, okay, we'll put in this rule. If you live within 50 miles, you can't.
Well, can we sum up what works and what doesn't work? I think maybe we hit on one thing that doesn't work is too much dependent on one individual, and if that individual's gone, that's fault. Effective use of modern communication tools helps to bring in younger members because they're internet-connected types of things. What else?
Well, I mean, if I were going to say one thing, I would say it's what works is really understanding what your mission is and staying true to it. Mm-hmm. And you'll attract people. But if you're kind of vague and amorphous about what you're about, I think, you know, people are going to come, you know, they find out about you, they'll come, but they, you know, may not keep coming, whether it's, even if it's visiting your website, much less coming to a physical meeting or not. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, at some level, if you're going to be an organization, you have to have some kind of a mission and be true to it, I think.
I would think that programming is pretty important as mm-hmm. well to attract.
Right.
That's what, if I can just take a moment. I come from the Free Congregation of Sauk County in Sauk City. And since we have regular programming every week, though it does vary, it seems to have increased our membership some.
Consistency.
Yeah, the second four Sundays are our UU services, but the first one is what we call a spiritual reflection hour, which is a small group discussion around a table about like this, led by members on certain topics. And then the third Sunday is a free thought forum, where we have a speaker and it speaks for maybe 20 minutes, and it's a dialogue in a kind of a congregational setting, but it's still a dialogue. And a lot of that comes from the heritage of the German free thinkers that founded the group. And so having that expectation of what the programming is going to be seems to have helped. You know what to expect. You know it's not going to be a UU service every time. And that way you can, some people only come the second, fourth Sunday. Some people only come on the third Sundays because that's the way they like to see things done. And so offering some sort of a variance, so it isn't the same every time, but still have some kind of continuity with, so that the expectations, so you kind of know what to expect.
I'm glad you brought up the free thinkers, because I think that they serve as a good model, and it's very old.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and it started yeah. in Germany in the 1800s.
And came over here, and this is the only congregation that has in the country and possibly the world that has continuously had membership. And it dwindled down to, so I've heard that there were three or four elderly white men wow. sitting around, what are we going to do with the building when the group disbands? We're celebrating our 125th anniversary this year. The group was founded, and the building was in that time period. But I agree that I think that's kind of been the extra little thing that we've had to kind of keep us going, is that the German heritage and having the building. And
how many people usually come for the services? Do you have like a membership and then?
The membership is at around 50.
Okay.
And I guess depending, you know, anywhere from 20 to 30, mm-hmm. sometimes less, sometimes more. Mm-hmm. And we do have speakers that are not really connected, you know, they're of a much wider range than just what you'd expect mm-hmm. in that kind of setting, I mean, we have to be careful about the political, you know, but it's a pretty wide range.
But I think that if you're only program driven, we're not going to make it. Because if I only came to Prairie when I found the programs interesting, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here right. about half the time. But I come for other reasons.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And so yeah, the thing is, if you can get your group big enough to where you think you can miss a session without scuttling the thing, then you right. achieve something, because otherwise I think, God, maybe nobody else will come, I better go even though I don't want. Mm-hmm. And I admit that when I do come, I have a good time when I'm leaving, God, I came.
That's been key to our group, I think, is that afterwards we always have time for socializing,
sure.
we go out
sure.
to dinner.
And that's really important.
Yeah, mm-hmm. so we get to know each other.
As the program is, but not all important.
Right. Another thing that was mentioned is meeting the needs of children as they grow.
And I wanted to ask Kathy, do you have a weekly Sunday school during the school year?
We did have it on second and fourth Sundays regularly, and we offer child care also, which was a help for the really little ones. And then we've added the third Sunday. And this past year was a real strong year. It seems to wax and wane a little bit, and part of it has to do with the parents that come forward.
Right, the volunteers.
The volunteers, as usual. So, it's been real strong for many years, but now some of those parents, their kids are growing out of it, and so they're so that is a struggle, and we recognize as well that that's really, really vital to
keep going.
But
when I belonged to the Lutheran Church, they actually hired someone. I think they had just had the parents put money in a thing to pay for that person.
Yeah, and that's something we're
for an hour or whatever, because, you know, it's a lot of commitments for the parents, and then they come there, they can't go to church, so they're basically babysitting everybody else's kids.
They get isolated.
Yeah,
right. That's what comes up in the skeptics group, too.
Is that happens here.
One parent will have to stay home, and they can't come to the group.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, and
even
of course,
that,
you run into the economic problems.
They can come and watch
we have a part-time speaker, and in an effort to maintain some continuity, so there's a cost there, but, and we're trying to maintain a building as well. So, it's 400 years old. So there's obviously a lot of there, right.
Those three men didn't leave you all the money in their wills.
Pardon me?
Those three white guys that were sitting around the table didn't leave you all the money in their wills.
We are pursuing historic structures.
Classification,
yes.
Yeah.
And so hopefully there'll be some help there. But the idea of hiring someone for REs, we'd do it if we could afford it. So,
all right.
Of course, increasing membership helps that.
Exactly.
Just the chicken and egg thing.
Exactly.
And we'll end up with a round of applause for our panel.